Anthropic Phenomena, Design or Chance, by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract of the talk. Some examples are given of phenomena that have come to be explained under the anthropic principle, and why these seem most strongly to point to a designer. What are these anthropic phenomena? There are features in our physical universe that are just right, or finely balanced, or finely tuned, or extremely good. We're going to look at just a few examples of these here. Water. See Barrow and Tipler's book of the Anthropic Cosmological Principle, pages 524 to 541, for an extensive discussion of this. I select just a few items out of their discussion. They mention on page 524 that water is one of the strangest substances known to science. On the same page, most of its physical properties have values enormously higher or lower than those of any other known material. Some of these features, of course, were already noted long before Barrow and Tipler wrote in the 90s. In, for instance, the Bridgewater treatises written in the 1830s, and in Lawrence Henderson's book, The Fitness of the Environment, written in 1913. Water, for instance, has a very high melting point, boiling point, and heat of fusion. The heat of vaporization is higher than any known substance. So water is the best possible coolant by evaporation. Water has a very high surface tension, a high dielectric constant. So it's a great solvent for polar molecules. Water, in fact, itself tends to ionize, again, making it a good solvent. Water is almost unique in having a solid state lighter than its liquid state. The upshot is that water expands on freezing. Other substances typically do not do this. This prevents the freeze-up of lakes, rivers, and oceans as the water, as it freezes, rises to the top and eventually becomes an insulator to cut down the possibility of the lake will freeze up all the way to the bottom. Of course, if it's cold enough, it will in any case, but over a pretty wide range of temperatures, the water will not freeze up all the way down. And so living things that depend upon liquid water can just go down lower into water. Water's expansion on freezing also aids soil formation by breaking up rock and such. Water has a higher specific heat than almost all organic compounds. Only ammonia is higher than that. So it functions very well as a heat source or heat sink. It will absorb a good deal of heat without rising the temperature much, and it will give up a good deal of heat without lowering its temperature much. The upshot of this is that water tends to stabilize the temperature of environments in which it is present. These striking features of water perhaps boil down to three features. The hydrogen bonds, the nature of hydrogen and oxygen atoms and how they hook together. The fact that water is a polar molecule, and the fact that water has the striking angle it does between the two hydrogen-oxygen bonds. Other life elements. Barrow and Tipler also discuss the anthropic significance of hydrogen itself, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, and these two are rather striking in the way they function in living things. Another example of anthropic phenomena relates to electromagnetism and gravity. This is discussed in Adair's book, The Great Design. I'll list these books for you in a bibliography at the end of our talk. Page 321. Both electromagnetism and gravity are what we call long-range forces. That is, the strength of the force decreases the square of the distance, or inverse square dependence, you might say. Electromagnetism, however, is enormously stronger than gravity by something like 37 powers of 10. Yet, strangely enough, gravity, so much weaker as it is, dominates on the astronomical size scale. The fact that gravity dominates on the astronomical size scale allows us to have hot suns and cool planets and life as we know it. Why does gravity dominate when it's so much weaker than electromagnetism? Well, the answer to this is that gravity is only an attractive force mediated by mass, which is only a positive quantity. Electromagnetism has both attractive and repulsive force. It's mediated by charges, and these charges can be positive or negative, those charges which are the same repel, so two positives repel, two negatives repel. Unlike charges, a positive and negative attract. Therefore, electromagnetism has a tendency to neutralize itself by attracting opposites together and canceling out. So the electromagnetic force tends to cancel out so long as there are equal numbers of positive and negative charges. But for electromagnetism not to dominate, its charges have to cancel out to much better than 1 part in 10 to the 37 powers, perhaps as high as 1 part in 10 to the 40th power or so. That is, the number of positive and negative charges in the universe must be very, very close to exactly the same. It's not obvious why this should be so. We don't know anything about the universe that requires that there be an equal number of plus and minus charges. Electrons are the main carriers of the negative charge, and protons are the positive charge. Electrons are very, very small objects compared to protons. Protons are nearly 2,000 times more massive than electrons, 1,800 and something. And so these two objects froze out at very different times in the expansion of the universe. As we understand today, the universe comes from a Big Bang and is very, very hot and dense at early moments, and this cools down until the situation we now reached is that the average temperature of the universe is quite low. And as this universe cools down and expands, the heat or temperature energy, if you like, in a given location becomes much, much smaller. Well, as long as the temperature is so high that it is above the amount necessary to produce pairs of protons and antiprotons, then you will have a large proton-antiproton soup, we might say, in the universe. But when the temperature cools down enough that collisions will not produce more proton-antiproton pairs, or that the gamma rays, if you like, the photons will not produce proton-antiproton pairs, then the protons and antiprotons, as they collide, will annihilate each other, and there'll be no more produced. And so you will gradually get less and less. And strangely enough, if there were exactly the same number of protons and antiprotons, they would presumably have all annihilated and there'd be none. But no, when the dust settles, if you like, there are protons left over and no antiprotons. Then the temperature of the universe drops by, again, nearly a factor of 2,000 times. And between the time that the protons froze out and the time that the electrons freeze out, there are lots of electron-positron pairs, electron-anti-electron pairs, and as long as the temperature is high enough, whenever these annihilate, there'll be other photons around that will produce proton-antiproton, electron-anti-electron pairs. But now when the temperature gets low enough for that not to happen, they begin to all annihilate one another, and when the dust settles, there's some electrons left over, but there are no anti-electrons or positrons left over. And we think that there may have been 1,000 times as many electrons and anti-electrons to start out with as you wind up with just electrons. But when it all settles out, the number of electrons and number of protons are pretty near equal. There are many more of these anthropic phenomena than the ones we have sketched here. I suggest that you see Hugh Ross's book, The Creator and the Cosmos, or Paul Davies' book, Accidental Universe, or Baron Tipler's book, Anthropic Cosmological Principle, for many of these additional phenomena. These phenomena point strongly to a designer for the universe. But this explanation is strongly resisted by those whose worldview does not include a designer. All of us have a tendency to want the worldview we've got, or go looking for something else, and often want to hold on to it very hard. There have been various attempts to avoid a designer. For more discussion on these, see the articles by John Jefferson Davis and by Rhoda that are listed in the bibliography at the end. These attempts to avoid the designer are usually some form or another of what we might call the anthropic principle. What's the anthropic principle? Well, the anthropic principle is the universe is the way it is because of humans. And there are typically two, actually several more, but two major versions of the anthropic principle, the strong anthropic principle and the weak anthropic principle. The strong anthropic principle says mankind caused the universe to be the way it is so humans could arise. And this is a view espoused by Barrow and by John Wheeler. In this kind of a view, either mankind is a manifestation of God, so we have some kind of a monism, as is characteristic of some versions of the New Age movement and of Hinduism and Buddhism, or causes operate backwards in time. Humans existing later on in the universe somehow act backwards to cause the universe to come into existence. There's little reason to believe either of these views, in time as a manifestation of God or causes operate backward in time, without very strong evidence, which we don't have. The weak anthropic principle is if the universe weren't the way it is, there would be no observers. Okay? Grant that. Since there are observers, the universe must be sufficiently fine-tuned for them to exist. Okay, well, grant that. And as I point out here, duh, is this an explanation? Well, this by itself is not an explanation. What follows the next couple panels are attempts to explain this. Okay? One is that we have a selection effect here, that the apparent design in the universe is a result of selection. Observers only exist in universes which are fine-tuned. But as we look through this whole list of anthropic phenomena, the variables are so fine-tuned, it's an enormous surprise that there are any observers. Leslie gives an illustration of this, a firing squad with 1,000 marksmen. What Leslie's illustration looks like. Imagine you have been condemned to death. You are put before a squad of 1,000 marksmen. They all fire. When the smoke clears, you are still alive. Well, the weak anthropic principle type person would say, well, if they had missed, you wouldn't still be here. It's true. What's the big deal, he says. What's the big deal, you say? Something else is going on. The basic idea is to postulate a large number of universes so that observers will be probable in one of them anyway. Okay? So if you have an infinite number of universes, then there are sure to be observers in some of them. If you've got a large enough number, even if it's not infinite number, then observers may be reasonably probable if the number of universes you've got is large enough. That would be quite large, by the way. How do we get a large number of universes? Well, John Wheeler suggests that we actually only have the one universe we've got, but that this universe expands and contracts between each Big Bang that takes place over perhaps 100 billion years or so between Big Bangs. And the successive oscillations of the universe between Big Bangs each have a different set of variables, if you like, basic constants. And every once in a while, one set will be good enough to allow observers to exist. Hugh Everett says that when quantum phenomena happen, instead of having a collapse of the wave function, you instead have a multiplication of universes every time something occurs, which Copenhagen interpretation would be a collapse of the wave function. Instead, what Everett says is every alternative that could happen happens, each one of them producing a different universe in which that particular thing happens, so that every moment in time, universes are branching into more and more and more and more universes. That's Hugh Everett's view, quantum mini-worlds. Leslie has what we call inflationary mini-worlds. He believes that our world is a bubble that grew from a bigger universe, and here and there in this bigger universe, new bubbles are popping up all along, and each of these bubbles has got a different set of constants in it, and we happen to be in one in which the constants really work right, so that there can be observers, but the vast majority of the others don't work right, and there are no observers. Well, those are various ways to postulate a large number of observers, a large number of universes, so as to make observers reasonably probable in one or few of them. But all of these views have problems. Successive oscillations of the universe apparently will not work. See Stephen Hawking's discussion of this. Hawking basically pointed out that our universe does not have entropy high enough to have been through a bounce, and that a universe that collapsed to bounce wouldn't bounce. It would pull itself into a black hole. There's no evidence for the quantum mini worlds, and it violates all sorts conservation laws, if you like. Inflationary mini-worlds is certainly possible. It's possible that our world inflated from a bubble that was in a bigger world. But the evidence for so many universes as would be needed to make a universe with observers probable by mere chance, the evidence for that is not comparable to the evidence for the existence of God. And that I sketch for you in lots and lots of PowerPoint talks on our IBRI website, so I won't sketch it for you here. Well, that raises the question of God. If God exists, the anthropic coincidences are not surprising. They're merely an indication of his design. Just as if a human engineer exists, the fact that two parts slide nicely together isn't an enormous coincidence. It was designed. If God doesn't exist, even need for so much fine-tuning as we actually have is rather amazing, not to mention that we actually have that fine-tuning. No science fiction writer that I know of, before all this stuff came up, would have ever guessed that you need to have so many things just right to even have observers in the universe. So you see in Star Trek and Star Wars and all of those, all these different kinds of intelligent beings on different planets, etc. Whereas we now have got excellent evidence that the chance of randomly having that sort of thing is zilch, basically. And so if there are intelligences on other planets, it's because of some kind of design. So, God. Thus the God model naturally explains fine-tuning. The no-God model must make huge assumptions to account for the anthropic phenomenon. Well, I ask as we close this talk, doesn't this have some practical implications? If there's a God, what are we going to do about it? Well, we suggest here in this talk that nature is telling us something very theological.